This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. Well, I'm so happy to be back here in the studio behind the microphone because it is so much fun to be in. It is so much fun to be in here. And thank you, Big Ed, for keeping everything so clean for me. And my goodness, now everybody smells like Eau de Clorox. That's our new smell, I guess, for this. I don't know what we're going to call these 2020. They're certainly not roaring 20s, and they're getting to be a little bit boring 20s. But that's why you need to read a good book. And so there are so many great books out there. Some are escapist, and at the bottom of the hour, I'm going to be talking to a wonderful author, Taylor K. Mejia, and we're going to be talking about her book, Paulo Santiago and the River of Tears. It is a book from the Rick Riordan Present series. Always fantastic books come from Rick, and I am so grateful to him for sending this book to me, and I look forward to talking about it at the bottom of the hour. But right now I want to turn to a book that's much more serious, and it's a topic that when I first heard about it, it was a difficult thing because I love poetry so much, and I've always been a great admirer of poetry. I was very fortunate that I had, as a matter of fact, when I first started the program, I had wonderful Juan Felipe Herrera, poet laureate, here on the program, and we had a wonderful hour talking to each other. So I know poetry quite well. So I just want to take time now to talk to an author who's written a book about her father, a Pulitzer-winning poet, Richard Eberhardt. And I want to welcome you to the program. So it's really an honor to have you here because, you know, I know that, this is not an easy book that you wrote. But it's an important book. And Gretchen Charrington, thank you for being with me on Joy on Paper today.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Patsy. I'm delighted.
Okay. Well, as I said, you know, I love poetry. And it's funny. Your father was born in Minnesota. I'm from Michigan, so yeah. I'm more aware of people of Michigan and Minnesota than the average person, because your father was born in Minnesota. And it's funny that Robert Bly, another great American poet, was born not too far away.
That's correct, yes. And Robert Bly and my dad were very good friends.
I know. And I had the privilege of seeing Robert Bly long, long time ago in Minnesota when he was doing one of his readings. And his daughter was on my program. But in your case, the book is beautifully written. You have literary talents. I don't know if you're going to stop with this book or if you are actually going to go ahead and write some other books, because you definitely have talent, and it's called Poetic License. And I just want to tell my listeners that it's available wherever books are sold, and we'll then also talk about your website. But why don't you introduce the subject, or introduce it the way you want to do, because, as I said, your father is very famous. Certainly anybody who knows literature and poetry in the United States has read his work. I've admired his work in the past. I had already known it. I knew Robert Bly's work more, simply because something about Robert Bly's work really gets into me.
Yeah.
But I'll let you tell your story, and because it is a difficult story. But you knew so many famous poets along the way that I think that also will be a fascinating part of your book.
Well, thank you. I'm happy to give you kind of a snapshot view, and then you can clue into whatever is of interest to you, really. So Poetic License is a memoir. It is my first book. I am writing more books after this, so to answer that first question you asked.
once you start writing, it's really hard to give it up, because it is.
No, that's probably true.
That's why I named the program Joy on Paper, because once you see your words on paper, it's addictive, really.
Well, thank you for suggesting that. So this book traces the arc of my complex relationship, really, with my father, the Pulitzer Prize-winning poet, as you mentioned, Richard Eberhardt. He also was the U.S. Poet Laureate under Presidents Eisenhower and Kennedy, and taught for 40 years at Dartmouth College in the English department there. The book, though, is grounded, really, in the 1990s, which was a particular decade that was my 40s. And it was when I began to research my father's life and his really extensive literary archives at Dartmouth College. He gave his archives to Dartmouth, and it contains 55,000 letters of correspondence between Dad and almost every known writer of the 20th century. It's really quite a collection. And one thing that's interesting about that particular collection is that whereas many writers hold the letters that are sent to them by other writers, not many writers hold copies of the letters they send to other writers. So in my father's case, in his archives, there's really an epistolary record of numerous relationships with poets and novelists and other authors, really through the, say, second half of the 20th century particularly. So in the 1990s, when I was in my 40s, I was beginning to have some questions about my father that I was having a little bit of a hard time, you know, figuring out. And I figured one of the ways to kind of get to know him better and to provide space for myself to think about the questions that I had was to gain access to this amazing treasure trove of letters and kind of trace my life, you know, from 1951 forward, along with his life. And so I was given the archives had not been quite cataloged yet, so they were in a storage facility, and I was given full access by the college and also by the Richard Eberhardt Literary Estate to peruse them as I wish. And I spent a good portion of 5 years in those archives, not every day. I was working full-time and raising children, et cetera. But I'd spend sort of a Monday there most weeks. During that same period of my life, I was facing sort of an existential crisis between the family myths that I had grown up with and my own lived experience. Both my mother and my father were just widely adored by people. Beloved by hundreds of people, and for very good reasons. They were both incredibly generous, gregarious, wonderful hosts. They loved having people come and visit in Hanover, New Hampshire, where we lived, or at our summer place in Maine. And so growing up, it was in kind of a literary swirl, you know, of famous people. It was rare to have a dinner time without people around the dinner table that weren't members of the family. And at the same time, you know, particularly as a little girl, I was sort of on the periphery of that swirl. I was a little girl. I wasn't the sort of named writer next in the family who would be my brother. And I've also been sort of a quiet person in general, and I've always kind of observed from the wings. So I was kind of on the periphery watching into the swirl of really powerful literary men, mostly, but not all men, definitely women too. And my father, again, was very generous with up-and-coming writers. Many, you know, would credit him with helping them start their careers. And so whether it was women or men, you know, they they were he was very anxious or eager to help recommend them to his editors and other publishing houses, etc. So during the 90s, while that was going on, I was also building a career in organizational development consulting, advising CEOs on beginning to face the truth about themselves and their own companies. This was a period when male CEOs, which is mostly what I worked with, were beginning to bring women onto their management teams and their boards. And they were, good ones, were interested in doing that proactively and also sort of figuring out how to work with talented, smart, assertive women in their midst, because that was new for some of them, obviously, way back then. So I kind of gained I gained some reputation, I guess you would say, in being someone who could help these men think about how they came across to the people around them, how their companies were really perceived by the employees that lived within them. And for those who were interested, I learned how to kind of translate the truth that was around them that they were wanting to see but not quite sure how to see into something that they could actually work with and change from themselves. So the crisis personally was in, between helping people sort of figure out how to look at truth themselves and also feeling as if my own lived experience with my dad didn't measured up in some ways, but not perfectly, to kind of the public view of him and to the view of hundreds of fans that were around all the time. So that's sort of the snapshot view.
And then there comes the poet and there's the man. And this is where you had to make a decision, really. There are so many ways. Well, there are a couple of ways that you could have gone. You might not have written anything. You might have written perhaps the story that most people would have imagined that would have been written about your dad. Because, as you said, he was admired, and he did help so many poets. I think Ginsberg spoke at his funeral, right?
Ginsberg, yes. Yeah.
And
was not at his funeral, but at a tribute.
At a tribute, and he lived to be, over 100 years old?
Yep, he lived to be 101 plus a few months. So he had a very hearty constitution, that Minnesota.
Yeah, that hardiness. Yeah, I think it's funny when my son moved to Wisconsin, we're in Florida, and he moved to Wisconsin. And the first winter, he called me and he said, "Gee, Mom, I didn't know snow was so heavy." So,
right.
So I thought, we, being I'm a youper. And so, of course, we are a hardy bunch. We learned to survive all of that.
Right.
And so in some way, so it was sort of heartbreaking to see the flaws in the people that we've admired, and that I know, I don't know what's happening with the people who you knew, the famous people you knew who have they, hear you tell about something that your father and sort of. It's difficult when you have these kind of problems. I don't know, what happened with your father? When did your relationship with your father? How was your relationship with your father after, towards the end of his life?
Towards the end of his life, it was fine. I think you raise a couple of points that are worth stopping on for a minute, that in writing this book, I did have many considerations about how to write it, and truthfully, it's taken me almost 2 decades to complete it. And so I started as a very nascent creative writer in the 90s, jotting down scenes, jotting down memories of events, et cetera, going to some workshops and trying to figure out just how to transition from business writing to creative writing, you know, switch off the business language and move into the creative side. And really, you know, through that long process, I've gone through a number of stages. And I think, to be honest, I think the first stage, in a sense, was writing about him almost as if he were on a pedestal, almost as if it were biography. Some of that was to learn his history. Some of it was because I hadn't given myself permission yet, really, to open up to my own voice. But I will say that in 1994, I believe it was, I visited my dad in the retirement home where he and my mom lived, and I visited him, and I'd been working in the doing research in his archives for several years. I felt it was time to let him know what I was doing, what I was up to, and that meeting was really quite pivotal for me because I had brought a rather innocent chapter that I was writing about his growing up years in Minnesota, and asked him if I could read it for him. And he had never really been interested in my writing before. He wasn't the sort of involved parent growing up in terms of homework and those kinds of things. That was my mom. And so, you know, I'd never really shared anything that I'd written with him before. And so I shared this short essay, and, you know, I said, "How does it feel for me to be writing about you?" And he said, "Why, marvelous, of course." And you know, that's a little bit of a peek at his own narcissism, kind of. I mean, he did really enjoy the accolades and the attention and all of that. And so I asked him if he could think of anything that, you know, he didn't want me to write about. When I asked quite directly, you know, "Is there anything you don't want me to write about?" And his answer was unequivocal: "No. The only job of a writer is to tell the truth." So I include that in my first chapter because it kind of sets the stage for his permission, if you will. At that time, you know, honestly not knowing everything that was going to be in the book, but for his giving me permission to be the writer that he would respect, which was the one who would tell the truth. And so then as far as his friends go, now he's died quite a while ago, and my mother also, too. Many of their friends are gone. But in the late 1990s, as I was doing this research, and then as Dartmouth put on this wonderful tribute to him in 1996, which included Allen Ginsberg and Donald Hall and Maxine Cuman and another about 10 or so really well-known poets who came to that tribute, I decided that it was time for me to reacquaint myself with them. I'd known these people as a little kid. Ginsberg's case, I'd known him as a teenager, which is when I first met him, likewise Anne Sexton. But the other poets like Donald Hall and Richard Wilbur and Maxine Cuman, well, not so much Maxine, but anyway, Donald Hall and Dick Wilbur in particular had known me since I was growing up. And then the other poets I had known, you know, through the years, either as a young adult or teenager, et cetera. So I took it upon myself to reach out to about a dozen of those poets to see if I could come and talk to them about what they understood of my father. I told them I was writing a book, a memoir. I told them what my purpose was in talking to them to hear their experiences of dad. And in my own mind, I felt if I felt safe to, I would share with them the fact that he had sexually molested me when I was 17. And as it turned out, each one of them was unequivocally receptive, welcoming, and supportive. There wasn't one of them that was surprised by what I said. They had seen signs of things from him. They knew him well. You know, they were around him, with him at parties, and they saw how he behaved around women, and you know, that was probably one of the most that was one of the sort of pivotal turning points for me, was really feeling like my sense of truth was the truth, and that There was this very complex side to my father that I think I try to explore and understand better through the course of the memoir. And I would say that, you know, like many complex people and like many powerful people, they are complex, and they have both, you know, real light inside of them, and then they also have some shadows that they either choose to deal with or don't choose to deal with. And I think in my father's case, he also was part of that generation of men where it was perhaps sort of okay to be a little bit loose with, you know, women at cocktail parties and stuff. In any case, the friendship that I developed with Donald Hall was probably the most important to me and the strongest. He became a real advocate and mentor to me as I was writing this book. But the comments I heard from Maxine Kuman and Allen Ginsberg and Cleopatra Mathis and Jay Perini, who knew him probably as well as anybody did, were extremely helpful to me in my own recovery process, but also in just allowing me to own my own story.
Well, it's a fascinating story, and I highly recommend it. It's called Poetic License. It's by Gretchen Charrington, and you have a website, which is called?
www.gretchencharrington.com.
That's as easy as can be. And it's a fascinating story and really brings to light a lot of that literary age, and I think that people will find it fascinating. Whether you know his poetry or not, you don't need to, because the story is interesting, and you have certainly found your talent here in writing, because it is really, really a very, very beautifully written story, and I think that it's an important story, and perhaps all the men out there should perhaps read it and think, what do I want to be written about me someday?
I know,
and
right?
And maybe here you have a great talent, and then you do something that's wrong, and it lives long beyond your life.
Yeah.
And so it's sort of a warning to a lot of guys out there. Think before you do anything. And
so I do. I mean, I certainly want to say that I appreciate both my dad's strengths and weaknesses.
Yeah.
And I certainly did learn my writing voice from him, and being around poetry growing up, listening to his voice every night practically of my life. You know, reciting poems and reading to others in the living room. And so,
well, you've picked it up. So I hope that your next book isn't quite as difficult.
I hope it won't be quite as dark in that way.
Yeah, I hope that you find a release and that joy on paper that I always talk about, and that you can, you know, share another story of something. I don't know what it's going to be about, but make sure that when it's done, I get a first copy.
And I'd be happy to.
Because I would love to have you back. And I really, again, Gretchen, I want to thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today. Again, the book is called Poetic License. It's available wherever books are sold. And, of course, on Amazon, you can get it right there. And I think it's a book that people should read. So thank you again for being on Joy on Paper.
Thank you so much, Patsy. I appreciate your interest.
Okay. Bye-bye now. Bye.
Take care.
Okay. Oh, wow. It is a difficult book, but it is, you know, that's why people out there, think about your life. Think about what you're doing in life, because things live sometimes long after you, and you don't want it to be something bad. You want to be remembered for something good. Okay, we're going to have a commercial break, and when we come back, I'm going to have a completely different type of book, really.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Have you ever faced disaster? The Red Cross is always there for you. The Red Cross responds to a call for help every 8 seconds. They have never turned anyone down. Now they need your financial support so that they can be ready to help you when the need arises. Donate online at redcross.org. Thank you.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at larsonpatentlaw.com.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more recording careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
This is the TAN Talk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z, and I am back, and I am so happy to be back here at TAN Talk Radio Network Studio here in glorious Clearwater, Florida. And I am also happy that I have a fascinating book to talk to you about. It's called Paolo Santiago and the River of Tears, and the author is Taylor K. Mejia. I hope I pronounced that right. Or I didn't.
It's Mejia, but you were very close.
Ah, wow, Mejia. I'm sorry. You know, it's funny because sometimes people have anglicized it. So I did another author about 2 years ago, and I pronounced it. I tried to pronounce it the proper, what I thought was the proper way, and I was immediately corrected. No, I said, oh goodness, I'm sorry. So repeat your name, because
no
it's
problem.
Really pretty. I think it's really pretty.
Thank you. It's Taylor K. Mejia.
Mejia. I love it. It's beautiful. What a wonderful name for an author. And the thing, it looks so beautiful on this cover. Don't you love the cover of this book?
I'm obsessed with the cover. It's Vanessa Morales is the author, and the artist. She did an incredible job.
It is so good. I mean, it should be a. I'm sure it's a poster that kids can have. It's just so beautifully done. Of course, it comes from one of this Rick Riordan Presents series books. Everything he does is perfect, and this cover, I just love this cover. Isn't he wonderful?
Yeah, it's amazing. He's wonderful. He's so cool. And the cover, actually, the cool thing about the imprint is that they always choose a cover artist for every book that shares the cultural background of the author and the main character. So they really, have such an awesome perspective on the design. Like, I didn't have to make any notes at all. She just, ran with it, and it's beautiful.
And they must love you, because they did it embossing in silver, sort of silvery.
Oh, my God.
And don't do... I keep rubbing my fingers over it.
Me too.
It's so,
yeah, it's so beautiful. All the different textures and stuff. I'm just like, wow, I've never seen a book that looks like this.
Yeah,
it's so
and the quality. Also, you can tell when a publisher really loves an author, and they do a great cover, but they also do wonderful paper. And the paper, isn't it nice? It's so beautiful. I just love it.
It's beautiful. It took, when I got my first copy in the mail, I just sat there just poring over it for so long. I was like just touching all of it, like, oh my gosh, this is so, it's a paper, like the paper quality.
I know,
so nice.
It makes a difference, I'm telling you. And the funny thing is, I get the book and I'm touching the cover and I'm touching the paper, and and of course I know immediately, oh, they love this. This is one of their star authors, and they expect a lot from you. And I knew immediately. First, of course, Rick wrote a little intro, and I said to myself, well, if Rick is writing the intro and he's giving you this great paper, the book has to be great.
a great paper. Yes, exactly. That's how you can tell.
Yeah, that's how you can tell.
The intro is so cool.
That's right.
I couldn't believe it.
What? Isn't it lovely? Oh, he's just, he's wonderful. And he's got such a great eye for talent. And he's right about you because, whoa. This story is, well, when I was a kid, all I was interested in science. I didn't like anything else. I mean, always the classes that I did the best in were anything to do with math or science or Latin. I like Latin because it was scientific. It was learning the names of animals and plants with the scientific names. That's what I loved. And so when I get such a kick out of how, and of course, she has, you explain the trio that start in the book and then about them, because it is, she's wonderful. Science, everything is like that. I love it.
Yeah, she's definitely very science-obsessed kid, which part of it is because, you know, she's pushing away, as a lot of 12-year-olds do, I think, from, like, everything her mom likes, which is the polar opposite. Her mom reads tarot cards and lights candles and believes in ghosts and ancestors and all this stuff. And Pau just thinks that's, like, so embarrassingly non-modern. She does not like it at all. So she's pushing away from that towards, you know, science and more logical stuff, but then also science is kind of the way she, like, explains the things that scare her to herself. So I think she, a lot of us, you know, most of the people in my family and, you know, other Latina friends and stuff, we were exposed to these, like, terrifying stories at a really young age. So I think Pau's reaction to that was sort of like, well, let's explain everything so nothing can scare us again. And then her best friend, Dante, is her upstairs neighbor. And they've known each other since they were little kids. And then they have another friend, Emma, who lives on sort of like the nicer side of town and is only present in the book for a little while before she goes mysteriously missing. And Pau is sort of forced to confront all her skepticism about the supernatural in order to help find her.
Well, it's funny. I'm reading the book. You know, it's been a while since my boys went off to college, and so I don't really have a lot of gummy worms or milk duds or any of those things hanging around the house. And so it just brought back all these memories. As I'm reading the book, I kept wanting the gummy worms. I'm like, this is crazy. I wanted that feel. You describe it. Let's just say I didn't want them used in the same way. But
you don't want sugar crystals up your nose.
No, but I just wanted to have that taste again in my mouth. And I, well, this is great writing, because when you get something, you know, and I love when authors put things in that are evocative and that make you. You feel, you know, for the character.
That make you want to eat a gummy worm.
Yeah, why not? You know, it just, you go sort of back in time. So this is a really, you know, of course, I know it's a Latinx a category now, you know, that it's, but this is a universal story, because I'm telling you, you have developed here a wonderful characters. And, you know, I like Pau so much. I thought, whoa, what? It's how she could, you know, do the constellations, and she knew the constellations, and she's interested in physics. And she's, this is, my two best classes were chemistry and physics. I loved him.
Oh, wow. So you were like the target audience.
Yeah, exactly. Of course, I got in a lot of trouble. In those days, let's just say in chemistry class, I was involved in a stink bomb. Today, of course, I would probably go to jail as a terrorist, and they send hazmat people in or something. You know.
Oh, yeah, it's a different world.
Yeah, it's a different world. We could have much more fun in those days. But I'd love that, and I think it will inspire a lot of kids to see the fun in science.
Yeah, I hope so, definitely. I think especially girls of color, I feel like are discouraged from pursuing like STEM stuff at a really early age. So I definitely wanted to show that, you know, yeah, science can be fun and science can be something that a girl likes, and you know, you can like science and still, you know, like resonate with all the stuff from your cultural upbringing. And I have a daughter. I was actually not a big science kid in school. I was, to no one's surprise, more into writing. But my daughter is 7, and she is just obsessed with all things science. So I actually had to, you know, ask her a couple of questions while I was doing it. I'm like, what kind of science experiments sound fun to you?
Well, I think it's. The wonderful thing about this book is it's really encouraging. There are so many aspects of just things that I found myself just enjoying the story. And then, you know, let's talk a little bit about this relationship with her mother. And I think it's important that you wrote about it, because there are, you know, there's all these relationship problems, but we can see also the love.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think it's, you know, maybe not in as extreme a way, but a lot of 12-year-olds and kids, you know, just like getting into middle school are starting to figure out how to kind of push away from their parents' beliefs and like kind of forge their own identity. So even if you have a parent who's like really great and who you love, you still have that instinct to sort of like forge your own path. And I think Pao's mom does a good job of giving her space to be herself, but, you know, still be there for her. And I think it's important to have that, like, to be able to push back against stuff and know that you still have your, you know, the support and love of your parents. So she's, you know, it'll be an ongoing journey for them, I think.
I think so, too. Well, of course, you're talking here about a Mexican-American myth. So tell us about this myth, and where, of course, it plays the pivotal point in this story. So tell us about it.
Yeah, it's a terrifying story. There's a lot of, I heard the version of it that I heard when I was growing up is this one version. There's like, I think every Latin American country pretty much has a version of it in their mythology. But the one I grew up with was a woman, an unmarried woman with 3 children in like a pretty small town along a river, drowns all 3 of her children and then feels so racked with guilt that she drowns herself, and then her whole afterlife is sort of spent like wandering the banks of the river where she drowned her kids looking for other children to drown. So I think I told myself as a kid that the myth must have sprung up because just the water is dangerous, but I have heard some really terrifying accounts of people who have actually had like experience with this ghost, like experienced seeing the ghost, and I'm like, I am not at all convinced that it isn't real.
Well, it is a scary story, and I was a little taken aback by it because luckily I was raised in northern Michigan, and the nice thing is the water's freezing. The water is freezing there,
right.
And nobody wants
pretty
to go in the water. And
yeah.
So we never had any of this scary stories, but I can tell you, if I had heard this story when I was a kid, I would have been terrified. So, it's pretty scary, but, I mean, you weave it in there and, so you make it,
yeah.
You know. But, so what was the reaction when you first, you know, you came out with the idea and you wrote the story? How did it come about?
Yeah, well, I heard about the Rick Riordan Presents imprint. I was very, very new to publishing. I had just sold my first young adult book, but it was still about 2 years from coming out. And I heard about the imprint because I'm just, you know, a fan of everything Rick does. And so when I heard that he was doing, you know, mythology inspired by authors who are writing from their own cultures, I was like, oh, I have to do this. But I was trying to think, like, okay, what are the really, like, cornerstone folk tales and myths that I grew up with as a kid? And literally all of them were terrifying. Like, oh, it's all ghost stories. Like, that's the stuff that really stuck in my memory. And so I started thinking, like, okay, most of his books and the other books in his imprint at that point were all kind of gods and heroes and stuff, and I was like, well, let's see how it goes with the ghost story. So I pitched the story to Rick, and it turns out serendipitously that Rick grew up in South Texas and was totally already familiar with the myth of La Llorona and like fascinated by it, so he was ready to take it on. And I think it's the first ghost story they've done at the imprint, and it's certainly the first ghost story I've done, so it was it was fun to explore, though. There's so much, you know, there's so much material in the things that scare us, I think, just the stories themselves, and then also the things they bring up in us and how the characters react to being just terrified all the time.
Yeah, and it was, I don't know, you know, I wasn't so terrorized as a child, but now I can enjoy it, you know. but it's, you know, as you said, Rick is quite amazing. And, you know, of course, part of it is ever since, you know, Percy Jackson and the Olympians, it's, you know, such an amazing stories. And he's really, he's doing so much for young people and encouraging reading, which is very important.
Yeah.
And of course, from your point of view, for Latinx side, encouraging girls to read more and to be interested in science. And if anybody doubts that women can do science and can do math, they just have to watch the movie Hidden Figures. To know.
No kidding.
Isn't that wonderful?
That's an incredible movie.
It is an incredible movie. And, you know, as I said, because that's really my love is, I used to do, you know, factor polynomials just for fun.
You know, wow.
It's like a weird, strange kid. but it's just, I like that aspect of it, that you're encouraging young people to think in critically, actually, think scientifically. And because there are so many things that you weave into the story that I found fascinating.
Yeah, thank you. It was so much fun to write from, you know, I think being a writer is so much about empathizing and kind of getting into the heads of people who maybe aren't exactly like you. So I'm such a, you know, like a creative, like a writing type person, and that's always how I've seen the world. But it was interesting to sort of get into that mindset of like seeing things through this kind of critical thinking, logical perspective. And I think it actually, in writing it, like made me a better critical thinker because I can get into that mindset better now. But that's definitely something I'm like learning every day from my daughter, who is like very logical, scientific kid. It's interesting.
So, you know, you tackle this, the race and the class conflicts in this fictionalized town. So it makes it a very relevant story for this time. And we just, somehow, it's just very hard to deal with. And I hope that young people will read this and see that, you know, this, all of these problems can be overcome.
Yeah, absolutely. And just, I mean, I think the first point that I was trying to make is not just that they can be overcome, but just that they exist in the first place. Like, I think so much of, you know, what we read and what we see, especially as, you know, Mexican American kids, is like stories where like the police are there to help you and like they're safe people to go to, and there aren't a lot of these like stressors and obstacles that, you know, our culture faces that maybe others don't. And I think it's important to show kids that, you know, that we see that, like we see that they're going through that, and that's, you know, not just like here's a way to get through it, but also like I think it's important and validating to just like show that we're aware that it takes a certain kind of bravery to be a non-white kid in this country right now.
Exactly. And what I, of course, writing young adult fiction is really a challenge all the time, because you have to be able to write, as I said, you have to be able to grab the reader at a very early right in the beginning of the book, and you certainly did.
Yeah.
You grabbed me with gummy bears. gummy worms. There are things that you sort of can play upon to grab that reader and get that reader involved in the story, that they become a part of it. And so you obviously have this talent, and you've been writing since you were a kid, I'm sure, and you're honing your talent. What are you working on now?
I just wrapped up the sequel to this book, actually, which will be out next summer. And then I'm working on an as-yet-unannounced young adult project right now that's definitely a new direction for me. So it's definitely stretching my brain in good ways. I've been reading a lot of, books about reading craft, going back to just, the beginner mindset. Even though I have a couple books out, I think there's a lot to be said for continuing to be a student. So I'm taking this strange time out pandemic to definitely get back into being a student of writing, and it's been really awesome. So definitely a lot of that, and then hopefully just kind of coming up with ideas for hopefully future books for POW and all kinds of other stuff. I have another book coming out in September.
And being with a 7-year-old.
Yeah. That's surprise fantastic. Homeschooling a first grader was a fun you, part of the...
Is she home in quarantine with you?
Yeah, she is. Yep, we've been home since March.
That's so wonderful. I homeschool my boys. So I was home with them 24/7 for over 18 years.
Oh, wow. So we just actually signed up to or submitted our notice to homeschool our daughter for the next school year. And I'm a little overwhelmed. She's a public school kid normally, so it's going to be new.
Well, I loved every minute. I am so grateful that I homeschooled my boys. And really, it was 24/7, and it wasn't enough. I would have had a 30-hour day if I could. I don't know, some planet. There must be some planet out there where I could have had 30 hours it, because it is so much fun. Because you are watching as they, and one of the things is make sure that you keep notes about it, and make sure that you really track it. In a fun way, do little videos of her reading today and reading the keep it up and all of it, put it all together. Of course, you'll write a book about it one day, but have those notes. But one of the wonderful things I just love is when you take a kid and you put them on a video to read a book that's not that's a little bit challenging. And you do it one year, and then a year later, you take that same book and you put them in the same chair, the same location, and you have them read it again. And then every year you
do
that.
That's a great idea.
And then you'll see that as they get older, they start being dramatic, they start being silly, they start being... and all of these things that you can do when you homeschool, because you have them all the time, and it's such a joy. Just anybody out there who has their kid all day long... be so thankful and be so joyous, because in some ways this pandemic is good for you because you had this wonderful opportunity. Make sure that you make it lots of fun. Don't worry so much
definitely.
About curriculum as making them, just giving them, I let my kids run with whatever subject they were interested. If they were interested in a country, I said, run with it. Learn everything about that country.
Cool.
Right? Do a map about it. Do everything. Let them, the same with math. I said, if you wanted math, do it. So they started math when they were 5. By the time they were 11, they were doing, they were way beyond me. They had finished geometry by the time they were 11.
They inherited your
level they were starting calculus. So let kids run.
Wow, that's amazing.
This is the way you have to do it. And just have fun. Every minute of the day is fun, no matter what.
You never
worry about it. Just enjoy it, because I can tell you, you're delightful. I love your laugh. I love your. I think it's fantastic. You're so sweet.
This has been really fun.
And I want you to just tell everybody your website.
Yes, it's TaylorKMejia.com is my website, and then I'm really active on Twitter and Instagram, too, and it's Taylor K on both of those.
Okay, but we have to tell everybody it's spelled T-E-H-L-O-R. That is such a lovely spelling, and it looks so beautiful on this lovely and beautiful cover. And I want to thank
you so much.
Rick Riordan again for, he's presented you to me, and I just am so happy about it. So I'll have you.
Oh, yeah, me too. This has been so much fun.
I'll have you back next year, Taylor, okay?
Yes, can't wait. Have a good rest of your day.
Okay, you too. Have fun.
All right.
And bye-bye.
Yes, I will. You too.
Okay,
bye.
Bye-bye. Oh, she's sweet. Isn't she sweet? Don't you love that voice? I love her voice. I love her laugh. What a girl. And very, obviously, very talented. Very talented. Now, I'm glad I didn't have this scary story. I really couldn't have taken that scary story when I was a kid. Because, you know, we lived by a lake. Lake Superior. And we didn't have any scary stories. I didn't have any scary stories. We had, like, Paul Bunyan might come through and chop down a tree or something. I don't know what he was doing. I guess, no, he was planting the tree. We didn't have any scary stories. We certainly didn't have any chainsaw massacres or any witches or ghosts or people, which I'm so glad I had a wonderful childhood. Just running around wild, absolutely wild, just fantastic. Oh, thinking about the forest, I will tell you that on Thursday, my guest is Karen Slaughter. And there she's writing a lot about the forests of Georgia. And I'm telling you, that is one scary book that she's written. And I had the joy of meeting Karen Slaughter here when she was at the Vinoy Hotel in St. Petersburg at BoucherCon. She's a fantastic author, and I'm looking forward to having her on the program on Thursday. And we'll talk about her real life, I don't know if it's real life, but it's a real life in her head story that she has come up with. And after that, you'll never want to go in the woods in Georgia, which is unfortunate because they're really beautiful. But I wouldn't go, you couldn't pay me to go in the woods in Georgia after reading a Karen Slaughter book. It's called The Silent Wife, and I'm looking forward to talking to her on Thursday. But everybody, remember what I always say. One of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken in an audible book. Or if you're very, very lucky, hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, a streaming video, or perhaps a series on the Hallmark Channel. Anyway, I want them. I have so many books that need to be turned into streaming video because I am so tired of looking at all those little squares on my television and I can't find anything to watch. We're all going crazy, square after square. I spend half an hour looking at the little squares. I'm probably going to start having nightmares about those little squares because there's nothing great to watch. And I have interviewed so many authors with great books. Hollywood, listen to me. I can tell you at least 10 books that you should turn into streaming videos, and they will be great stories, wonderful stories, and everybody will just love to watch them. And somebody needs to do something with Hollywood. I need to go over there and I think maybe take one of those big billboards and tell Hollywood, listen to Patsy with a Z because I know great authors and I know their books and I know which ones will make wonderful streaming videos. I think I would like to start with Jill Block's The Truth About Parallel Lines. I could write that script today, this afternoon. I could sit down and write the entire script. I know the book so well. Anyway, say something nice to somebody. I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Big Ed. Uda Clorox has gotten into my nose, and I can hardly breathe anymore. But anyway, thank you, Ed. And he's saluting me, and I'm saluting him. I should have been a general. Bye-bye now.